Welcome to Agents of Smooch. I'm director Annette Weirstra. During our summer vacation tour, especially in our stops in China, India, and Kenya, we talked about exploring more stories outside of our own North American perspectives. And one of our new agents, Saria Veerapan, who is part of the selection committee for the Toronto South African Film Festival, suggested Back of the Moon, which will be featured at this year's festival. The movie has been getting a lot of acclaim at film festivals around the globe. And this year, since they are going online, the Toronto Film Festival has teamed up with their sister festival in Vancouver to create an online Canada-wide South African Film Festival in support of Education Without Borders. So if you want to watch Back to the Moon as well as other movies and documentaries coming out of South Africa, the festival will run from November 1st through 12th, and you can get more information and tickets at www.tsafftsaf.ca, and I'll put the link in the show notes. Unfortunately, Saria cannot join us tonight, but I was able to recruit two more special agents, starting with Special Agent Moises Chuyan. Hey, Moises.
Hey, how's it going? It feels like only, a few hours ago I was editing a conversation that we had with Kathy about Brendan Fraser movies months ago.
Sometimes we hoard episodes until they are convenient for us. And we also have a brand new agent, Cicero Holmes. Hey, Cicero.
Agent Cicero Holmes reporting for duty, ma'am.
We're always excited to have new agents who are happy to talk about romance with us.
Yes, I love it. I see what I did there.
Yeah, I do. Very sneaky. Yeah. Where else can everyone find you when you are not being an agent of Smooch?
They can find me randomly rolling dice at TPK right here on The Uncomparable. Woo-hoo. They can find me running around in everybody else's podcasts all over on The Uncomparable Network. But not on The Uncomparable, you can hear me most regularly on the Discovery Debrief podcast, where we talk about all things new Trek. So Lower Decks, Star Trek Discovery, Star Trek Picard, and all of the new shows that are going to be coming out on CBS All Access. And follow me on Twitter at Stubby Stan.
Awesome. There's always new Star Trek coming out, isn't there?
There is now, which is great.
That's awesome. Today, we're here to talk about Back of the Moon. And the IMDb description of this movie is, on the last day of his life, a gangster finds something worth living for.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Spoilers.
I know. Right, right. Like, they spoil that kind of from the beginning.
Yeah, but I think that kind of goes into, they want you to know that as part of the setup, as part of what is going down throughout the whole movie, because when you're not being tuned for a surprise, you know what this means for this character, mm-hmm. and it changes the context of how you watch the movie.
Yeah, you know what's funny is I didn't read that part of the description or the description at all. Until I was maybe a third of the way through the movie and I was trying to figure out who Badman, who mm-hmm. Bruh Max was. And I saw that and I was like, oh, okay. But it didn't change the resonance of the mm-hmm. film for me at all. I was really, really enthralled with it.
This is a movie set in a single night in July 28, 1958, Bra Max, or Bad Man, who leads a gang of vipers in Sophiatown. Sophiatown is a black community just at the edge of Johannesburg that is slowly being shut down street by street by the white government. This is the night before Max will be shoved out of his father's home. And at the same time, members of his gang are getting ready to push him out as leader. And this is all set against our romance. Max is in love at a distance with the singer Eve Masomi, who is about to leave for London tomorrow. And circumstances push them together for a single night. So it's interesting because this is our first tragic story that we've really covered. And not, I guess, being romances frequently, they are happy endings and rom-coms and stuff. But I think this movie is kind of amazing, even though we are watching a tragedy, and it doesn't really diminish that romance or the story of Max and there's so much in this movie to sort of think about and talk about.
Yeah, I don't know if this is a spoiler or not.
We kind of talked about the conclusion of the movie right up front. So, you know,
I will say that whether or not this is a tragedy depends on your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And the narrator says that as the opening setup for mm-hmm. the film, that it is. So, yeah. So I don't know if that's a spoiler or not.
Well, I mean, to me, it sets the Shakespearean stakes of what we're getting into.
Yeah,
absolutely. Your perspective about whether or not this is a tragedy depends on from whose point of view you're viewing these events. Because if you're viewing these events from the point of view of the narrator, then you may have a different perspective on
mm-hmm.
how this all unfolded, and you know, when at the end, is that still like, I'm so confused. I'm trying not to spoil anything. So I'm so confused about whether or not I've actually spoiled it.
Maybe let's start just by giving our general impressions of the story. Then we'll just blow the spoiler horn right away, because we need to.
I used an adjective there, Shakespearean, mm-hmm. and that isn't in any way to colonize this story with English oppression, but using it as a comparative term, to me it speaks to the music and the poetry of the story that's being told. This is about class stratifications. This is about people under oppression. One of the most common themes that, understandably, you find in historical South African cinema is apartheid itself, period. And specifically when it comes to people being crowded out and gentrified to call this a neighborhood is being far too generous to the white overlords that ruined South Africa for far, far, far too long. The beauty thing for me about this story is that it is not being told about South Africa by a Westerner. It's being told about South Africa by South Africans. It takes forever to see a white person contemporaneously filmed who isn't in stock footage, which is an utter delight. I am not an expert in African languages, so I don't know if, as IMDb says, the language being spoken Zulu or if it's Xhosa or what. But the flipping between bits of English and indigenous languages is gorgeous. It's beautiful.
And French.
And French.
And French.
Mm-hmm. Oui, madame. The movie has a little bit of everything in it. It's got all sorts of different people who are serving all sorts of different roles while trying to scrape and survive and make it. As much as people like to pass around headlines about stuff, this goes deep emotionally with mm-hmm. all of these people. There's a lot of ugliness witnessed in the course of the movie. There's a lot of violence, physical and sexual. It is unapologetic about that. It is unapologetic about the, to me, very realistic misogyny of the 1950s wherever you are on the planet.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Frankly, misogyny that's still there. Homophobia that's still there. But I was expecting something good based on the way that Annette had hyped this up to me. but I did not expect to have one of those kinds of experiences I would have at physical film festivals in my living room the way that I did with this, where it just blew my hair back. And I am still, as many words have spilled out of my mouth, I have trouble articulating the richness and depth of this story overall. This broad tapestry within which is the through line of this romance from a distance, the longing from a distance, and how this man spends his last day. And at a certain point, you know, there's a club called Casablanca, and there are tinges of Casablanca, the movie, in here too, where it's the guy who knows that he is kind for specific reasons why he is stuck metaphorically or physically, however you want to take it, where he is stuck, and how he chooses to spend the time that he has left on Earth, however long that may be. We don't go into the movie with him going, oh, I've got a ticking clock, I'm dead in 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. It's not that kind of a thing, but it's kind of like there's this ever-present thing looming over him of him knowing that at some point it's going to be his time. You know, that's basically where he is.
Yeah, well, for me, you talked about Casablanca, Moises, but for me, I saw a few different movies in this film. I saw West Side Story.
Yeah.
And you know, in much of the romance, and I saw American Graffiti in this film, in the same way that, like, it wasn't even just that the periods for both of those films matched the period for this, but I felt in tone though these movies were stories about these people, these young people, and another group of people that were oppressing them, you know, and obviously the ways that oppression hit in Back of the Moon versus those other two films is starkly different. But another film that it reminded me of was Do the Right Thing, where I felt like, again, this was a film that took place in a day. This was just a day in the life of these people. It was a very specific day in the life. But this film could have taken place, the events of this film could have taken place 2 weeks before this or 3 weeks before this. Like, the situation would have been eerily very similar. This impending dread of gentrification under, you know, under the oppressive nature of this authoritarian, you know, authoritarian government, and how that trickles down, how that level of oppression trickles down within these ghettos, where you wind up having this kind of dog-eat-dog mentality, because it is about survival. And their neighborhoods really gave you a sense of that's how they were, you know, this is how they had to live. But even within that, you got to see the beauty of the structure of the organization within the hierarchy of the community, and how there was, even in the amidst all of this chaos, that there was respect and love and fun and joy despite everything else that was happening for them.
Yeah, you get to see swatches of the complexity of a lot of these relationships from characters that you maybe get three lines out of and only see for a few minutes total. Yeah. Yeah. A couple minutes even,
right.
And that's enough, and you get what you need out of it. You know, again, like, the comparison to Shakespeare is something that I mean directly as a compliment for right. the complexity of what is going on. There's nothing less richly detailed and artfully constructed here than there are in the greatest of the Shakespearean tragedies. You have so many people going through so many things every day for these people in Johannesburg is a Shakespearean tragedy, right. In some respect or another, and they all have a different part to play in it. It really is staggering how I resist making a lot of comparisons to other movies. I mean, loads of gangster movies, Scorsese gangster movies, Goodfellas, Casino, that kind of thing, because this thing completely stands on its own. Sure. And my urge to make those comparisons is because this is like an original artist coming out with an album that is all greatest hits.
I think for me, it really struck me as very filmic and like that kind of epic feeling, but also really intimate. So you got to really get a sense of those characters, as you both say. And I think there was there's moments where I'm like, this movie is so concise with getting a lot of information across, because it's not like they're giving you, this is the history of this era, this is the history. Like, they'll tell you and either you'll figure it out or you have to go look it up. But I think they convey a lot of information about what is happening very concisely and precisely, and giving you a lot of depth. And I also really felt like, even though you hardly see any white characters, there's that omnipresent feeling of the oppression of the system at that time. And we're really seeing, as you said, Cicero, how all of these groups of people are reacting differently within that, and how, you're just feeling the weight of oppression on these people and how that manifests in a lot of different ways. And I do appreciate that even though there's a lot of darkness and violence in this film, there still is that element of hope and community, and sort of kind of, even though the violent story is sort of one of the central through lines, you're seeing all around it and about how there is a community that is supporting each other and approaching this in different ways. Like, even just seeing in the club all of those people dancing and listening to music and living a much more sort of peaceful existence than perhaps the Vipers until they show up, you know?
Right.
I mean, you, at the very outset, you know, we have our chorus setting the scene. Mm-hmm. Again, Shakespearean comparison,
right?
And as we meet characters, you know, Ghost, we know who this dude is. Mm-hmm. Immediately.
The
singer, you know, we get who she is. Stryker, her boxer boyfriend, we get who he is. Badman, we get who this dude is. The kid, you know, the flunkies, you know, we get very clear characterization of all of these people from the word go. We don't need to wait for scene two to get who this person or that person is, where they're in the pecking order, who they are in the hierarchy. You know, when this mentor character, Owen, I think, shows up and, well, he doesn't end up so good. We get who he is almost instantly, where it is so abrupt that it's almost like, wait, have we met? No, we have not met this guy before. This is literally us meeting him as he is about to walk into expectant doom, you know, a bad situation. They don't give us more time than is absolutely necessary to get stuff across. And I never felt lost the entire time as to whose relationship to who was what. And I didn't need that delivered in dialogue. A lot of it was just, I mean, it was body language. It was relation to each other in physical space, the staging, the framing. It's very cinematic. It's very theatrical. It is very poetic and very musical. I'm just, thank you, Annette.
Well, thank you,
like,
Saria.
What a gift.
Because she's
you,
the
Annette.
One.
Thank you, Saria, yes.
Yeah, she's the one who brought it to us. And I remember she said to me, South Africa doesn't really do rom-coms. And I was like, it doesn't need to be a rom-com to be part. Like, that's not the only kind of romance we're going to talk about. And so she brought this, and I was really intrigued. And you know, I'm really glad.
That points to one of the things I still find hilarious about this show is that starting out, we were like, the focus is romance. It's not just rom-coms.
Mm-hmm.
It's
no,
not
absolutely.
Just quote-unquote chick flicks. And people go, oh, that, you know, you, so I don't know if it'd be good for your rom-com podcast. I'm like, it's not a rom-com podcast. We talked about, you know, Bridget Jones, but like it's not all rom-coms.
Well, because, you know, we want to talk about romance in all of its facets, because it does intersect with so many other genres. And, you know, we're doing some Halloween crossovers with romance, and you know, we can do a lot of different things with it. So I'm really glad. I'm like, how did it take us so long to do something that is just like, this one feels like really so filmic and beautiful that it's a different kind of movie than we've done, but I don't think it strays out of the premise of what we really wanted to accomplish, because it's like, we want to talk about romance in conjunction with so many other things.
Yeah.
we will now, if you want to kind of like not get too much spoiled for you and go watch this movie, which you should go do if you can, feel free to pause, go find the movie, then come back and listen, or just be prepared. We're going to get more into this story. And now, Cicero, you can spoil all you want.
All right. All right.
Let's get into it.
Yeah. So the first thing I want to say is, let's throw out some roses for our Richard Lekunku, who played Bra Max and you know, or AKA Badman. He was, so I thought the performances as a whole were very, very good, but he was next level. Like, he, every scene that he was in, he was my focus, even over Eve, who was absolutely gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. But from a performance standpoint, like, he really drew me in. And the director, you know, the director obviously knew what he was doing. The shots were really great. The first time we see Bra Max is after the narrator describes who he is, like, that he is he's the leader of the Vipers. He owns the gun. He's the guy. But his mom tried to take him away and send him to France. He learned some, you know, or to the Congo, and he learned some French, and then he came back. But, you know, he's a gang leader. And we the first time we see him, it's over his shoulder, and he's reading a book. He's reading Invisible Man by Ellison. So, you know, like, this, so, like, so, you, so if you notice that, you're like, oh, wait a minute. This guy's not just, he's not just a gang leader. Like, there's depth to this guy. And then you get to see his interaction with the kid, which, you know, is very patronly and loving, which seems about to be on point with who we thought this character was. But then we find out about I guess it was Mamba who was, you know, stealing from people, and he was going to make him fillet him. Like, wait, what's happening here? This doesn't seem to jive with the person that we knew. We assume this guy to be Badman. Mm-hmm. And then he flips it again. And I, like, all of that was really, really great. And everything that he did throughout the course of the film, I was definitely here for and a fan of.
Catching him reading the book by Ellison made me go, oh, like, they're just literally putting stuff in the edge of the frame that they want us to see and look for and let the movie breathe, where they're not packing it with dialogue. They are just confident enough to let this thing play.
There were also moments where he could go from looking completely ominous and threatening to being quite vulnerable in just the switch of an expression, which I think there was one moment when they're all in the room, the characters in the room, and he looks at, you know, the gang members, and then he looks at Eve, and his whole expression just changes in such a dramatic way, but so subtly that I was like, damn. That's good. Yeah. He is amazing. So I also agree that he is sort of really takes, well, he is the central, you know, character of this movie, I feel, but it is also, like, he's just so good in this.
I think everyone else, if there was a critique of the film that I could make, it's that he was too good. Right. And that, you know, everyone else, while they did play their role, were, you know, like, even the actor who played Eve, she was really, really good. Beautiful voice, beautiful woman. But, like, acting wise, I felt like even she was overmatched with who he was. And, like, so I didn't feel chemistry between them. I felt his love for her making her love him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I didn't feel like there was equal energy there in the performance.
I'll disagree with you, to an extent,
right?
But what I think we meet in the middle is that the two of them have, it feels like they have diverging acting styles to me. I think that's what it is, because what I appreciated so much about her performance as Eve is that the way she plays the nuances of being in peril. This is a situation that she has been in the past, where she is surrounded by men who have ill intents.
Right. Yes.
And she is going to figure out how to survive, not to come out clean, but to survive. What she put into that scene on its own for me was the masterclass portion of her performance, where she is incredibly present, incredibly alive, and the camera is letting it, you know, tell so much of the complexity of who this woman is beyond the, you know, the fashionista singer taking photos out by you know, some salt flats.
Right. Right.
So I think it sets her up initially as maybe not being as complex. She doesn't as a character have as much lived experiences as he does. And that's an unfair playing field for her to be on, you know, to compare them directly, I think. But the stuff that she gets to do later on in the movie lets her stretch and do more and evoke more than she gets to do early on in the movie, where she's, you know, a pretty girl who sings. And that's pretty much who she is.
You have won me over, Moises. You are correct, sir. You are correct.
Well, I also don't think when you say, like, you don't feel the chemistry coming off of her as much. And I feel like that actually makes sense from the story perspective, because he's been following her, sitting there watching her. And I mean,
let's be honest, he's kind of a creep.
Yeah. Well,
sure.
I say kind of. He's been a creep. Let's let's not mince words.
But it's not, is it? Because it's just, he's not imposing himself on her. Showing up to listen to her sing is a very gentle way of creeping on someone.
Sure,
and
sure.
So he's not imposing on
Gentle creeping is the best kind of creeping.
Gentle creeping, maybe the episode of the title of the episode. But I think, you know, he's built her up, and I think he loves her as much as perhaps what she represents, which is a different choice and a different life, and going off to London to pursue her career as a singer. It's like, I think she represents a different choice. And one of the things I really saw as a theme is like people seeing, but for another choice, you might be in a different situation, especially for Max, like the capacity versus reality. And I think a lot of it centers around what choice will Eve make could really affect whether or not I knew Max wasn't getting out of this night. I was like, is Eve going to make it? Was a real question for me.
Yeah. I was trying to figure out was how many points of geometry was the love angle going to take in this film?
Mm-hmm.
Because we had Eve and Strike. And then the second we saw Bruh Max in Casablanca, we knew Bruh Max was also part of this triangle. But we also knew that Nat, you know, the valet personal assistant / manager, was also in love with Eve and let us know pretty plainly how he felt about her very early on in the film.
Mm-hmm.
She had a very physical effect on him. So it was always interesting to see those dynamics play off of each other, because Nat was always watching out for her, but he was, you know, he had this unrequited lust but was always looking out for her best interests. And then even so much as to go and find Strike while Strike is having sex with another woman after the fight, to grab him, you know, to grab him so that they could go and save Eve. It was that level of complexity was refreshing and kind of weird. I was here for it. I was definitely there for it.
He also had the presence of mind to pocket the passport that Strike took away to yes. take away Eve's ability to leave uh-huh. and yes. puts the choice back into her hands.
Right.
I thought that was important.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it was, you know, it was something that someone would do when they're in love with someone.
Mm-hmm.
That was the thing that you got to see, is that even though the lust was unrequited, the love was definitely exchanged between the two of them. But it was a platonic love. But his romantic love was still there, and he was still looking out for her and her best interests, whatever they may be.
I think that you also, in contrast to that, see sex and sexuality used as a weapon in other circumstances. We see the young woman who is assaulted and raped in the Back of the Moon. Back of the Moon, by the way, I don't know if you mentioned, is the name of the club.
Right.
That is sort of the contrast to Casablanca, which is sort of the posh club. This is like a little hole in the wall, sort of looks like it's almost in someone's kitchen and living room where people are gathering. And when the Vipers come, they assault a woman. And as well as, so they're like physically violently assaulting people with knives, stealing things. Like, again, we said earlier about the misogyny of the 1950s is very evident, and the homophobia, because they also use sex as a weapon in terms of punishing. And Ghost learns from Bra Max to use right. the gun as a representative of the penis, and makes the kid use it like he basically give it fellatio. So that, which is like so utterly violent.
Right.
And yeah, it's just, again, because we haven't talked about movies like this, we haven't talked about sex being used as a weapon like this.
Yeah, yeah. The sexual assault popping up is very abrupt and very shocking.
Mm-hmm.
And is shocking enough that it gave me a bit of numbness to, oh, okay, well, that's, wow. Okay, they're really not holding back with this. And, you know, the homophobia, you know, layered onto their obsession with telling people that their lives are on the line to get on their knees, and whether, you know, put a gun in their mouth or tell them to give some guy head or something. You know, the brutality of actual seasoned criminals, they don't hold back from it. Like, they don't hold back with Batman either. I mean, they let Max, you know, one of the first things you see him do is threaten somebody's life, literally using his genitalia as a weapon of intimidation. And it's tough. It's tough to handle. It's tough to watch. But I don't know how I would feel about them sanitizing that out of the narrative. You know, I believe in trigger warnings. I believe in content warnings. I think they are important and have a very important purpose, because there's a lot of lived experience that people have that they do not want to have dredged up to the front of their mind while ostensibly watching something for entertainment.
Right, right.
People don't watch entertainment to be traumatized, even though that's something that we all acknowledge is a part of it a lot of the time. Yeah, it was tough for me, and it took the movie doing a lot, not to win me over on characters, but to win me back over in the wake of that stuff, because I was concerned that I was going to get a steady stream of just that. And that's not to say that it's invalid or shouldn't be portrayed in terms of accuracy to the time period and to the type of story being told, because as bad and worse happens every single day in every country in the world. But yeah, it was something that I wouldn't say turned me completely off the movie, but it was something that had me needing the movie to give me a reason to keep going and justify why it was depicting stuff like this. But it ended up earning that relatively quickly. It wasn't something that it took me, by the end of the movie, I felt like it was it was worth the mild amount of trauma inflicted by seeing that stuff.
Yeah, I it was, I mean, it was definitely jarring, right? Mm-hmm. And disturbing to see it. But the one thing that I thought about when viewing it, as I was trying to process, you know, what I was watching, was the fact that this is a different culture. Like, you know, like this is, so, you know, not only is it a period piece and that, you know, they can strive for telling authentic versions of stories from that period, but it's also a different culture, and within, you know, I have seen South African films. I haven't seen a ton of South African films, yeah. Especially not dramas to this extent. I think the most dramatic South African film that I may have seen before this was District 9. So, but like that part, like I got like, okay, well maybe in South African cinema, this is like, these types of visceral scenes are more commonplace, and that, you know, in American cinema and in Western cinema and you know, by and large, these types of scenes are implied. And so you don't have to deal with that stuff, but you know, maybe in South African cinema, that's not how they view these things. So, okay, this is what it is, you know, like, me, the implication of it is just as bad as seeing it, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's still disturbing to see. And I was able to continue to move forward with the film. And like you said, Moises, I mean, it pulled me out for a second, but it didn't completely make me distrust the film and the stories that it was trying to tell.
Yeah, it definitely took me out of it, and I had to, you know, get comfortable giving it my full attention again. And, you know, admittedly, it's the kind of thing that, you know, if I were in a movie theater at a film festival, I wouldn't be able to jump onto my phone and, like, check Twitter or my texts or something like that. But,
right.
I had to abstract myself a little bit.
Sure.
You know, you said, you know, it's from a different national culture and different ethnographic culture, but I mean, rape culture is everywhere, and
that
we see Western cinema get into so many arguments about, oh, well, you know, how could we depict horrible things being done to people? That's just uncivilized and whiteness. My. Yes, we simply don't do that in a civilized society, and so on. It is the choice to depict sexual assault the way that they do is something that troubled me greatly, but it is something that, on the balance of the film, I end up greatly respecting the choices that they made regarding how much to show and how much to hold back. You know, after seeing the sexual assault being committed, there is the threat of sexual assault later in the movie.
Right.
But past that initial instance of it, we're not subjected to it again. We get it. We got it. And I appreciate that on the filmmaker's part.
And it is quite brief. You literally are peeking through a door that gets pulled shut again. And it to me, it felt like just demonstrating the violence of the community. And in contrast, not even in contrast, sort of lining up with the physical violence with the knife, like Owen gets killed so quickly that it's like jab, jab, people are dead. And it's then the thing I thought was very pointed was the pool of blood that stayed wet for a very long time in the film, showing how much, how little time had passed, but they are literally having, well, and they're having a romantic conversation, and he's wooing her and walking around this pot, like this blood, which I felt was really symbolic of just sort of, this is how our life is, that it's so common that we don't clean it up. It just is there. It's present. And it is this ever-present piece of violence that is something that we live in.
That is the beauty of this story. And it's one of the reasons that I liken it to Do the Right Thing, is that when you're an oppressed peoples and you're in your community, there's this ever-present dread of something that is completely out of your control, and it allows for chaos to exist as normalcy, because your world ultimately doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
They're living in hovels because they have been pushed out of their ancestral homes based on something completely trivial, and they're powerless to change that. So they just have to make the best of what they have. And as Eve and Max are sitting there discovering each other, it's in the midst of a literal, figurative, and universal Catholic chaos.
Mm-hmm.
So this pool of blood that is sitting on the floor is the least of their concerns, because what's most pressing for them is to maintain, to be present with each other, because that is how you maintain your sanity when you live in just abject terror and utter chaos.
Yeah.
And I think they did a really good job of displaying that in this film, you know, just simply because, like, leaving that pool of blood there and not having the moment where, you know, as soon as Max sits there in his guilt, trying to live those dual lives where he has to pay respect to his elders, to his mentor, but also show that level of machismo and bravado that made him the leader of the Vipers. And he had to serve both of those masters in that moment. And it led to his mentor being murdered in front of him. Having that guilt, you know, usually what you'd see is someone on their hands and knees with a bucket scrubbing the floor,
mm-hmm,
while all this other stuff is going on. And he's just like, the hell with that. I'm just going to look at some old pictures and lay in the bed and take a nap. This day is over. You know, like, that is, I thought that was a brilliant story choice. And mm-hmm, it really went to illustrate just what those conditions really were like.
I think, too, like, because you have two very different characters in terms of violence, and you have Max, who is trying to, in some senses, control it and direct it, and then, right, you have Ghost, who does not see him as strong enough, so he doesn't want to target and direct the violence away, because Max says, we don't do this to our own people, whereas, right, Ghost clearly has his sort of little sub gang and saying, we do this against our own people. Right. And they're, weirdly, Max's choice is a more moral choice, I think, as it's presented, than, you know, so like we are living under this violence and we will react with violence, but not against our own people. And they've made very different choices around that.
I want to talk about the language choices. I think we talked about that. Well, it wasn't language choices. It's just the dynamics of being a native South African, you know, watching people. So I think IMDb and Wikipedia had it partially right. So at points they were speaking Zulu. At points they were speaking Xhosa. I can't click my tongue.
Mm-hmm.
But then they were also speaking English, along with French at different points in the story. But it again went to further illustrate the the dynamics and the like the way colonialism works, right? And in so I grew up in I was born in the South Bronx. I spent a lot of time in the South Bronx, and we have a thing in the South Bronx called Spanglish, where
we have that in Texas too.
Yeah, right.
We imported it from the Bronx.
Yeah, right. There you go. But like, yeah. So you know, there was a huge influx of Puerto Ricans that moved to specifically to the South Bronx. You know, at one point there were more Puerto Ricans in the South Bronx than in all of Puerto Rico. You know, what would happen, and by and large, really, what happens in New York is that the way that people speak, you'd wind up hearing people have conversations, start a conversation in Spanish, and then by the time the sentence ended, they were speaking English. And, you know, and it was just like, yeah, well, this is how we converse now. Like, you know, why try to come up with a word, translate a word for that means the same thing that we already know the word for. So let's just go ahead and do that. And like, just like how complex your brain has to be. You know, if you're in South Africa, where someone could be speaking potentially four different languages in one sentence, is just amazing to me. And to like see that happen or see that play out and have not one of those languages be Afrikaans,
mm-hmm.
which was the you know the native tongue of white South Africans, was very, very interesting to me. It was really cool to see.
The fluidity of it is really beautiful to me.
Yes.
And we saw the same thing when we talked about Rafiki, which is a Kenyan film, and they switched between, I assume it was so Swahili and English. Right. And like so at some points you're like, oh, I didn't even, like, I'm not even recognizing they're speaking English because you're, you know, reading the subtitles and so
right.
on. But they flip so fluidly in both these movies in a way that I envy and wish I spoke any other language as well. I do think, because my family is Dutch, which is one of the roots of Afrikaans, I heard right. some words in there that was like, oh, I recognize those words. So I think there might have been a touch of Afrikaans in there. Kleine, like small. So there's little, like just words that would kind of pop out because that I don't speak it, but the tone and sound of it is really familiar to me. So, so there was a lot of interesting things happening with language. And to me, it was very cool.
Well, being Cuban, there are aspects of Cuban slang that are very heavily influenced by African languages. And I mean, you know, my dad was a Santero, like Santería is a thing that was, right. That was, you know, part of my life, and that goes back to Mother Africa, and so there are all kinds of consonant and vowel sounds that echo the way that they influenced the, you know, molded multilingualistic society that my dad's from. Where growing up, I would get a mixture of Spanish and English from both of my parents. More predominantly Spanish from my dad, and there would be Chinese thrown in there too because he was Chinese Cuban, and it would be you know, a little bit of Cantonese flowing into Cuban, flowing into English, and it was invisible to me. And even though the mixture of languages being spoken is not a mix that I speak beyond the English bits, it felt oddly comforting for me. Because that was part of what made me weird as a kid, was I was not just multi-ethnic, I was multi-ethnic. I was the multiple choice of test questions. I was so glad that they made the movie the way that they wanted to make it, accurate to the period, accurate to the area, without making any considerations for, oh, we need to make sure that, you know, the white people in America know what's going on.
Right.
Look, if you can read subtitles, you're fine. If you can't, well, okay. I don't know if you're good enough for this movie.
A lot of stuff is coming out with dubbing as well, though, because I like to do things while I watch shows, and so I've been watching some Spanish shows, and if I'm watching, I'll listen in the original language and watch the subtitles. And then if I'm doing something, I'll actually have the subtitles on and the dubbing on, and then I'll be like all caught up in how different the two different dubbing and subtitles are translated differently.
Yeah, and the subtitle,
because that's kind of nerd I am. I'm like, oh, look at this, they're saying it slightly different here. And but generally I prefer to listen to the original language, but you know, sometimes it's just convenient to do, like, it just makes it more accessible for people who want to listen in their own language. And Netflix comes out with a lot of stuff, and it comes out in a lot of different languages, which I think is cool for making things more in reach for a lot of stuff that we would never run across. Right. It has become a lot more accessible because of things like streaming services.
Yeah, look at that. The world gets smaller. I know.
So there's no excuse for us not to watch shows from other places.
Is there anything we didn't hit?
Well, so you know what? I think there is one thing that we didn't hit. Mm-hmm. So you guys, I guess we, because I allowed it, pulled the wool over our dear, sweet listeners' eyes and ears. Because we keep saying that Max died at the end of this film.
It's true. It's true, right?
Yeah.
Twist.
What we know is no one ever saw him again.
Yeah.
And honestly, I feel like that synopsis is still accurate because the gangster who died was Ghost.
That is right. Mm-hmm. That is true.
And I love that is what it sets people up for. I dig it as a red herring. I think it is so beautiful. I'm proud of us for playing along properly, but I'm much prouder of them for going, yeah, here we go. This is what you're going to expect. And then they go, oh, nope, that's my rug under you.
I think it could also be considered a metaphoric death, because we don't know if he did or not. I feel like if he's never seen again, though, that implies they didn't find his body.
Right.
But I feel like it's a metaphoric death of him as the gangster, and that it gives him a chance to kind of start fresh and be perhaps the person he and his mother would have liked to have been. That's how I interpret it.
Maybe the kid, after he became a doctor, worked on him, gave him plastic surgery.
Or maybe he went to the Congo, he went to Paris.
Yeah.
Like, he kind of wanted to, so.
Yeah. This, I really love this film. I love the fact that what we end on is gentrification, is apartheid. Like, never forget, this is... You know, we got to see a day in the life of these people that lived in Sophiatown, but never forget, this is what life was like for people that lived in Sophiatown. You know, and you get to see the end of that with via archival footage. Not enough people, in my opinion, not enough Westerners, especially Westerners of a certain age, know enough about apartheid and know enough about what it was like in South Africa into the 90s, mm-hmm. You know, like, so I, you know, I'm really looking forward to seeing more films and more filmmakers come out of that region that are, you know, that are creators of color that can tell their stories authentically. I'm hoping that the success of this film, the critical success of this film, inspires more creators out there.
How about for you, Moises? Any final thoughts?
I think I've said pretty much everything that I came into this wanting to say. The performances are all tremendous. I think it's a crime that only two of the actors are credited on the IMDb page. Mm-hmm. Yes. Somebody should do something about that. Seek this movie out. Make a point to see this rather than whatever garbage Netflix is telling the world everybody has to be watching this Friday. Enola Holmes, I'm sure, is really good, and I do intend to watch it, but I got other stuff to watch in front of it. And if your priorities need to be, I need to watch, you know, something that is more comforting, totally understandable. But if you are in the headspace to handle a movie that deals with these kinds of brutal themes and historical context that is still vividly relevant, sadly, over 60 years later than when this was set, you know, stare into the abyss so that you can help pull us out of it. Seeing that, there can be a brighter dawn on the other side of a dark day, you know, it helps some people. Some people, it is too dark for what people are going through right now, and they just need to watch reruns of Paddington Bear from the BBC. but this for me was the kind of thing that I wish I had seen in a festival audience of 1,200 other people in the Paramount Theater in Austin, Texas, or, you know, at the Bell Light Box in Toronto, Canada. You know, there is an audience for this, and it's anybody with a socially conscious mind who likes richness and depth in their storytelling.
I think for me, this will definitely be one of those movies that stick with me. And I like that I learned so much about this period and this story without it being a heavy-handed, here is a lesson, we are going to teach you about this period in history. Like, they do it so beautifully and so elegantly that that it will stick with me far more than a documentary would have, or a different story that was not told as well. So I just think I really appreciate having the opportunity to watch this. And if you are looking to see it, and I don't know if the online festival like stops at the Canadian border, or if hopefully other people, because it is online this year because of COVID, usually it's in Vancouver and Toronto. Me being in Edmonton, it's not, I cannot usually access this. So it's an opportunity for us to see some more films. So including this one, which I think might be one of the headliners of the festival.
All right.
Yeah. Back of the Moon deserves it.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And I watched Enola Holmes and this movie this week, so you can balance out a movie like this by watching something funny and charming too.
I had a Henry V movie that I had to watch that bumped Enola Holmes back, but I think I'm finally getting to it on Friday.
Yes, and I think it's good to balance these things. I don't know that I do get that in a like pandemic times. I'm generally seeking lighter things, but sometimes it's good to stretch yourself a little bit and try something different.
Worth it.
Yeah, that's good. Well, thank you so much for joining us on your first and hopefully not last mission, Cicero.
I hope I scored high marks.
I think you did. I give you full marks. Right. And thank you for joining me again, Moises.
Thank you for having me, as always.
And for the rest of you, I am sure we're going to see you all again soon, since we are also watching lots of Halloween-y spooky movies this month. And it'll be fun. So stay safe out there. Agents of Smooch is part of the Incomparable Network. If you are enjoying our show, please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the Smooch Agency, you can become a member of The Incomparable at theincomparable.com/members. Members can choose to support us and any other shows on the network, and you get extra perks like hanging out in the members-only Slack channel and bonus content such as our growing list of incomprehensible Agents of Smooch tipsy commentaries. Thank you for listening. Your next mission will be coming to you soon. Thank you.